Today at Reader's Corner, Nicholas Shakespeare, author of the new book Ian Fleming, The Complete Man, which chronicles the life and career of the man who created James Bond. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Question 12 of 24 on the 2020 test for British citizenship is, who first introduced James Bond? That shows what an enormous and ongoing impact on the British culture Ian Fleming's greatest creation, Bond, James Bond, has on Britain, not to mention the rest of the world, including this interviewer. In his latest book, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man, Nicholas Shakespeare examines Fleming's life with only 12 years as a thriller writer, but an impressive career in naval intelligence, which put him at the heart of critical moments in world history, while also providing rich inspiration for his fiction and playing a role in the creation of America's CIA. Nicholas Shakespeare's books have been translated into 20 languages. They include The Sand Pit, which is a contemporary thriller, The Voices of Elena Silvis, and The Dancer Upstairs, the latter of which was made into a film by John Malkovich. His nonfiction includes the critically acclaimed biography of Bruce Chatwin, the English novelist and travel writer. Nicholas Shakespeare, talking to us all the way from Wiltshire, England, near Stonehenge. Welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start, Nicholas, with the basics. I understand that until you embarked on your research about Ian Fleming's life, you had what might be termed a caricature of him until you learned two things about his life and career. Tell us about your original take on the man and then what you learned in preparing for the book.
Well, I'm a novelist before I'm a biographer. And 5 years ago, I was as far away from England as I could be on the island of Tasmania, south of Australia. And I'd begun a novel. And suddenly I get a call from my agent in England saying, we've had a very interesting proposal. The Fleming estate wants to appoint a new authorized biographer to do a new life of Ian Fleming. There's been one authorized one before in 1966, and a lot of material's come up since. And would you be interested? And I confess that my first reaction was hesitation, because although this was an enormously flattering offer, I mean, everyone's heard of James Bond. He's more famous than God in places like Tibet, where there is no God. I felt as an English person who'd grown up in some of the same situations as Fleming and had heard a bit about him and had observed him from sideways glimpses, my first reaction after flattery was, as I said, hesitation. And I think the moral of his story, which I've now learnt 5 years on, is don't run off with the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail if you wish to avoid forever after being rendered into tabloid fat, because that was very much the caricature, a Daily Mail-inspired caricature I had of the man. I saw him as a kind of rather arrogant old Etonian bounder who would whip his wife after coming back from the golf club or his London club and go to his bedroom upstairs while she entertained lots of intellectual friends and pulling the blanket over his head to try and drown out the sniggers below of these people reading the sex scenes from his latest James Bond book. And I didn't feel this was a particularly sympathetic character. So what I asked was to do 2 months of due diligence to see if I really did want to commit myself to being 3 or 4 years in the company of a bounder. And what I found were two things. First of all, he was a lot kinder than I'd anticipated. Again and again, the women he'd had affairs with or who'd fallen in love with him, and as Rebecca West said about the numbers of women who fell in love with him, they were enough to fill the Albert Hall, poor dear. It was also the men who were loyal to him, who he'd known largely since childhood and school days. These were upstanding, upright people, not at all people who would have spent much time in the company of a cat. But again, both the men and the women talked about his kindness. Now, kindness is not a quality I had associated with James Bond. And it's a very big prize for a biographer to try and rescue it. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, he was a lot more important than I had imagined. I think the caricature of Ian Fleming, as my wonderful editor at the Daily Telegraph, Max Hastings, marvelous military historian, he can't be shifted from the idea that Ian Fleming, during his 6 years in naval intelligence in the war, was nothing much more than somebody responsible for in-trays, out-trays, and ash-trays. And that, I think, is what I too had thought. He was a kind of chocolate sailor who sat at his desk while all his contemporaries went out in much braver circumstances and often sacrificed their lives, while he had a really cushy job in room 39 at the Admiralty. Well, as soon as I started poking this caricature, it collapsed, because Fleming was actually in the inner sanctum of British intelligence in a way that two other writers you've heard of, Graham Greene and John le Carré, both writers I knew in my life, who had traded on their intelligence connections to a great degree, were not. I mean, Graham Greene was a minor functionary in West Africa counting the number of condoms that were illegally being shipped to England during the Second World War, while John le Carré had a small job in Hamburg and in intelligence, and I don't think ever had one successful operation. You wouldn't know that from their reputations. Meanwhile, Fleming, who people accuse of trading on Bond and pretending to be Bond and really inflating his intelligence credentials, was one of only 30 people who were ultra cleared in 1940, ultra being the code breaking place at Bletchley, which cracked all the German submarine and Air Force and Army codes using a machine a bit like a typewriter that Fleming would later write his Bond books on. Well, Fleming was one of only 30 people who had access to this information. He also set up Fleming Commandos, which were a group of up to 400 people who went in with the advanced troops into North Africa and Sicily and France and Germany to try and get the Enigma machines and the code books and the cipher papers and send them back to Bletchley. And the contributions like this, historians think, shortened the war by 18 months. But more important for an American audience is that he was one of only two or three people in the room, and sometimes in the bedroom, when vital decisions were being made about the American Foreign Intelligence Service. I think your listeners will find it hard to believe that in 1941, America did not have a foreign intelligence service. And Britain was desperate to bring America into the war. America was neutral at that moment. And Fleming is one of those handpicked officers who goes out to New York and Washington and tries to persuade Colonel William Donovan to become the head of a new organization which can be modeled on British naval intelligence, which Fleming helps to set up in Washington in various meetings in Georgetown. In Donovan's presence, they hammer it out together during the May and June and July of 1941. And this becomes the OSS the following year, and in 1947 it becomes the CIA. And Fleming knew very well people like Alan Dulles, who was later the head of the CIA. He knew Donovan very well. He knew several other people like John Bross, who basically Fleming not only helped to kind of massage what the CIA eventually looked like, but also probably fingered out one or two of the appointees. And then, of course, 6 months later, Pearl Harbor happens and America comes into the war, and they've already got an up and running foreign intelligence service, thanks largely to people like Fleming. And that's when Churchill talks about the special relationship between Britain and America, what he's really talking about is the intelligence relationship. And what he's really talking about is the half dozen people who were helping to set that up. And Fleming was one of those. Now, that is not really part of the Daily Mail caricature of the chocolate sailor. So having discovered these two things, that he was much kinder and much more important than I anticipated, I said that, yes, I would write his life.
So Fleming was oftentimes asked, was there someone who was your model for James Bond? And he would say, at least in one part of your book, and again, I just want to stress with our listeners, I've just absolutely enjoyed this book from cover to cover. It's just so loaded with insights on what was going on during this man's life. But he mentions William Stevenson, who you identify in your book as a freelance spy master. Tell us about Stevenson, and why would Fleming say this is the guy I could have modeled Bond after?
Well, Stevenson is the third reason why I agreed to do this book, because my wife, who's Icelandic Canadian, told me, oh, William Stevenson, he grew up in our family in Winnipeg. Uh-huh. And I said, tell me more. It turns out that my father-in-law, Dr. George Johnson, who was head of health in Manitoba in the 1980s, he revealed in 1980, when Stevenson came back to Winnipeg for his first visit since 1922, having left town as a bankrupt, being hounded by all my father-in-law's patients who were creditors of Stevenson, that he was not at the quiet Canadian, as he became famously known, or the man called Intrepid. He was actually called William Stanger, and his mother, who's Icelandic, had deposited him in my wife's family in Winnipeg when he was four, and then vanished from his life forever. So Stevenson, Stanger was in the family of the Stefansons, whose anglicized name he took, and he grew up there until 1922, when he tries to get all the family to invest in a company that will fabricate a can opener. Well, that completely fell bankrupt. He fled town, gets to England, and he becomes a friend of Max Beaverbrook, who owned the Daily Express. And suddenly he marries a Tennessee Tobacco heiress, and suddenly he's recast himself as a person who's a friend of Churchill and who is having his own intelligence agency looking at industrial secrets in Germany and Austria before the war. And suddenly in 1940, he's sent to New York to be in charge of British intelligence in America, the Caribbean, and South America. And he and Fleming get on incredibly well. I think Stevenson is also slightly like Charlie in Charlie's Angels. He's a kind of invisible person at the top of the Rockefeller Tower, sending out, you know, his agents to all parts of the earth. And in fact, Fleming gives the idea for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. originates with an idea from Fleming that he sells to MGM for £1. But you also have that kind of invisible person present there. Stevenson was very much this eminence grise who was pulling all the strings, and Fleming was one of his puppet masters. So yes, Fleming did say that if there was one person that Bond kind of might have been inspired by, it was Stevenson. But I have to put a caveat on that, in that I've counted now of the people who claim to have written Shakespeare, my great-great-great-great-uncle, there are now 119 claimants to the authorship of Shakespeare, and there are almost as many claimants to be the models of James Bond. And I would say, in answer to that, James Bond is probably a mixture of all the things Fleming himself did, all the things he knew about, all the agents he himself sent into battle on operations in the Second World War, plus bits of his father, Val Fleming, who was a great hero in the First World War, who died when Fleming was eight in 1917, and also partly modeled on Fleming's elder brother, Peter, who was a commando before commandos came into being, who was an incredibly brave soldier, a much-traveled man, who Lord Halifax thought should become Viceroy of India. So I think Bond is a mixture of all these people. He's not one person. And I think we kind of do him a disservice when we try to kind of hitch a fictional character on a real person, just as, you know, there's no model for George Smiley in Le Carré, his model on Vivian Green in one instance, but actually he's a mixture of all the people that Le Carré's met and then tweaked to into fiction.
Right. Speaking of John Le Carré and George Smiley, I remember somewhere in your book where you talk about how, in the case of Le Carré, he always remained uppermost in someone's mind when you would think of his novels. But when it comes to our friend here, Ian Fleming, he gets lost to some extent. That may be the wrong word. You can fill it in. But Bond kind of overwhelms Fleming's life, and it's not the same. as it was for Le Carré. Is that right?
Not at all. I think you put your finger on it. I mean, Le Carré was a great curator of his own image. So we do think of Le Carré before we think of George Smiley. With Fleming, it's absolutely the opposite. We think of Bond before we think of Fleming, even if we think of Fleming. And I think there are many reasons for this. I mean, I don't think he's lost against Bond. I think Bond has kind of killed him, which is what many of Fleming's family felt. I think Fleming's sister, Amaryllis, said, "I think Bond murdered Fleming." And it's almost as if there's a kind of Frankenstein monster he's created with this fictional character who's now world famous. I mean, you can't open a newspaper any day without a Bond reference. There's no other person who comes near this in fiction. I mean, we've long ago stopped talking about Batman or Sherlock Holmes or Superman. James Bond is the iconographic go-to when you need just start counting from today on. It's like Stick Insects. You'll suddenly see it everywhere, James Bond. Now, that's a remarkable achievement, but it's at the cost of the author, Ian Fleming. I think one of the reasons for this, of course, are the films, which have taken over from where the books left off. Fleming died in 1964, age 56, having written 14 Bond books. There are now 25 or 26 films, I believe, with more in the pipeline. The films have completely submerged Ian Fleming. And so I suppose it's a kind of Frankenstein story that he wanted to be famous. He wanted to be like his brother, Peter Fleming. He wanted to be like Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene, his friends and contemporaries. And right towards the end of his life, he became even more famous than them with his name's on in lights in Leicester Square. I mean, I think in his last year, they sold something like 25 million copies of James Bond books. I mean, this is way beyond the fame that any English author had ever had, probably. And yet he's now forgotten. It's Bond who has risen, right. A bit like the one-man British Empire. The lower the sun sets on the British Empire, the more radiant the glow of James Bond.
And to your point about the movies playing a role in this, I wonder if you could give us your take for our listeners who might be thinking by the time our conversation here is over, well, I've got to go out and get either one of his books or one of his movies. What's lost in the movie that a reader would get in one of the novels? Is that that sounds like a good question to ask a novelist, Nicholas.
Well, I'm going to answer it by saying what's gained. And I think what's gained is a great sense of humor, which is slightly lacking in the books, which are cracking good yarns and and very well written. I mean, he writes a great speed. He writes each book in 2 months, which was the length of time it took me just to do the footnotes for my book. And he writes always in 2 months in Jamaica, in this very simple bungalow on the edge of Montego Bay, and or near Oracabessa, and he doesn't even look to reread the pages he's written. So the first time he looks at the book is when he's finished it, and then he spends the rest of another 2 months editing it. And I think that's the great strength of the books, is that they're written with great speed. He was a journalist trained in Reuters, so he knew how to write quickly and succinctly and clearly. And I think that they have a pace that you don't often find in his contemporary writers. He liked to liken the pace to kind of somebody following water skis behind a boat. He wanted that to be, he didn't want, you know, to have to kind of have nice, decent writing or poetic writing, which would take you away from the action. And I think they're still very readable. Now, the films, they take the essence of Bond and they play fast and loose with it. They set it in the future, or they set it in a completely different period. But what they keep is the essential ingredient. And I asked Barbara Broccoli, the present producer, the daughter of Cubby Broccoli, I said, what are the ingredients you wouldn't fiddle with? And they were very simple. He has to be English. He has to be male. And he has to do things for Queen, King, Country, and Commonwealth. And he has to be not corruptible. Apart from that, you can do anything you like with James Bond. But I think he has to stick to those ingredients. And those are the ingredients in the book. So whatever you do with the films, you've still got to pay homage to the character from which they come.
Your mention of the fact that Ian Fleming wrote his novels in Jamaica reminds me of a very sad part of this biography. It's about Fleming's only son, Casper, who was bipolar. And you make the observation that Fleming himself, you have to wonder, because almost anything you can say about Fleming, the opposite is also true. But getting back to Casper, he goes down to Jamaica at one point to write a novel, and he hands the kid off, who's very young, to a relative. And at one point in your book, you say, when Casper, the son, kills himself with an overdose in age 23, you say, he revealed Ian Fleming's fundamental weakness under all the flamboyance, one wounded child creating another. What made Ian Fleming a wounded child?
He had an awful mother who was very beautiful, but completely controlled the lives of her four sons. You know, she chose their girlfriends and she got rid of their girlfriends. She chose their jobs and then got them out of their jobs. She chose where they lived. She held the purse strings right until 2 weeks before Fleming died. His mother was alive, still keeping back his father's wealth, which she was only going to distribute in her own time, at her own leisure, and not until she'd more or less got through it. So I think he had, although he was a child of, his grandfather was born in a Dundee slum and rose to become the richest man in Europe, finding Fleming's bank and financing the American railroads and becoming a friend of J.P. Morgan and all the early bankers. Fleming himself, although surrounded by money, didn't actually have access to much money because his father died in 1917, when Fleming was eight, and the share of the bank passed back to his grandfather. So Fleming grew up surrounded, as I say, by money, but not having too much access to it himself, which is why he had to join the Sunday Times. It's why he had to write these novels. And I think his mother, who dictated the path he took, in the end, he ends up marrying a kind of version of her with Anne Rothermere, the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail. And she's a very tough cookie. And although it's wonderful when they have an affair, when they get married, when she's pregnant with Casper, it's almost like wedlock becomes bedlock and landlock. And he writes Bond, his first Bond book, he's writing a few weeks before his marriage, almost to escape the impending horror of domestic life, to retrieve his bachelor self. And you'll notice that in every Bond book, Bond is always kind of still a bachelor by the end of it. The only time he gets married, the wife is shot on as they speed off for their honeymoon. So I think his life is not a happy one, even though it might seem from the outside to be one of immense privilege or overprivilege. It doesn't protect you from the ups and downs of what you're going to encounter if you're not at ease with yourself.
Right. It may surprise our listeners who have followed either the Bond movies or the novels to learn that there was a movie based on a children's book that Ian Fleming wrote. It's called Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I remember taking my kids to see it. Tell us where he gets the chitty from, and then you might even explain more about where he gets some of his other characters from, like the famous Moneypenny.
Well, he pinched Moneypenny from his brother's only novel. They had a bet to see whether they could write a bestseller, and his brother writes a novel called The Sixth Column, which is absolutely atrocious. And in it, there's a character called Moneypenny. Other names he pinches, like Blofeld or Scaramanga, from, and Chitty too. There were two brothers called Chitty and Chitty at Eton, where Fleming was at school. And you see quite a lot of kind of Etonian references in his novels. He's quite a dab hand at pinching his friends and putting them into his novels. He has a great friend called Boofy Gore, who he makes into a gay gangster.
I know where that's going.
And so I think, yes, he has fun with the names. And James Bond, the name possibly comes from a bird watcher who wrote a book called The Birds of the West Indies, called James Bond, an old Harrovian who turned up at Goldeneye right at the end of Fleming's life to kind of not to reclaim his royalties, but to just be. He'd never read a Bond book, I don't think, or he'd started one and given it up. So yeah. It was rather an amazing meeting when Ian Fleming meets the character who he'd possibly based Bond on. I think other characters, Goldfinger was named after an architect, I think he's known. Blofeld, he was, Henry Blofeld, the son told me that he was in Boodle's Club and was looking for the name for a villain, and he suddenly picked up the membership list and saw these three Blofelds, all of whom had been at Eton. He said, that's the name I want for my villain. where characters get names. He told George Simenon, the French writer, that he would get his names from looking at shop fronts as he drove through France. And indeed, Le Carré chose his pseudonym, Le Carré, from a shop front from the top of a bus on the Tottenham Court Road. And I often wondered if Le Carré had chosen it in homage to Fleming, because you see in Fleming's writing about Monte Carlo that he talks about the croupier's call, Le Carré. And Le Carré himself had been to Monte Carlo with his father and watched his father gamble away the family's non-existent fortune. So I thought, and Le Chiffre, of course, the first Bond villain, is the cipher, is, you know, that suggests Le Carré, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. 10 years before Le Carré writes The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. So I emailed Le Carré this just when I discovered this, and I didn't get an answer because he just died that night, so I'll never know.
Yeah, really. Well, Ian Fleming founded and ran the 30 Assault Unit. You referred to it earlier in one of your answers. It was this British commando unit that was known as Fleming's Secret Navy. And there was one other key player that you were able to find. His name is Bill Marshall, and I want you to tell the story of this Royal Marine. But first of all, you might explain why you felt like you were the Grim Reaper in doing your research and finding some of these people.
Well, yes. Often I would meet them, and a few days later they would no longer be on this planet. And this was the case with Bill Marshall. He's the last surviving member of the commando unit called 30 AU, Fleming's Commandos. And I'd arranged to see him the following Wednesday. And I was so excited that I had thought it was the coming Wednesday. So I turn up to his little flat in Milton Keynes, and a gruff voice answers and tells me that he was expecting me the following week. Anyway, he agrees to see me, and we have 5 extraordinary hours in which he acts like a lightning rod back into D-Day and driving a van, sending messages back to Bletchley, and then getting into the German naval base at Kiel Harbour and digging up top secrets that was sent back to Britain and America for torpedoes and top secret fuels and possibly atomic secrets. This man was at the coalface of all Fleming's operations. And for 5 hours, he talked to me. He was there at D-Day, but he was there before D-Day. He was one of those who went in earlier to kind of case the joint, as it were. This is all stuff that hasn't yet come out. And indeed, Bill Marshall told me that when he looks up himself in Admiralty records, he doesn't exist, and that the full secrets of what he knew won't be released until 2050. Anyway, he released them to me and told me amazing things. And 5 days later, he was carried away to hospital. And had I not seen him and gone a week early, I would never have learned all the things I learned. So yes, I was a bit of a grim reaper.
You know, President Truman gave Fleming the ultimate honor for his service, the Presidential Medal for Merit. But the British government never did give him any decoration. I think somewhere in your novel you point out that that may have been something that Fleming always was concerned, felt badly about, that he had not been properly acknowledged by his own government.
We have to be careful here, because I think if you're in intelligence, you know that you're not going to get publicly saluted. I think in Fleming's case, it was more complicated because his boss, the head of Naval Intelligence, Admiral Godfrey, also mysteriously was overlooked. He was sent in 1942, suddenly, to the backwater of India to be in charge of the Indian Navy, having been at the epicenter of British intelligence until then. And there's always been a mystery about why Admiral Godfrey was removed. And Fleming was very, very much in Godfrey's pocket and admired by Godfrey and allowed to almost act as Godfrey. And I suspect Fleming became, this is speculation, but I expect he became a victim of the treatment meted out to Godfrey, who it was discovered had a German mistress in London during the first 3 years of the war. And I think that may have flagged up to the authorities that he may have been a security risk. And so until we untangle why Godfrey was removed from his post, I think it's associated with why Fleming never got much more than verbal recognition. And I think this adds to the mix of why he wrote these books. He kind of wanted to rescue some of the operations he'd planned and had shelved or put into operation and set them in a Cold War setting. And this was his outlet. I think one of the things to remind your listeners is that he wasn't really an instant success. Indeed, he was going to give up Bond or having written From Russia with Love, his fifth Bond book. And what rescues him are two things: the Suez Crisis, when Anthony Eden foolishly invades the Suez Canal, and in the middle of the kind of disaster, Eden goes to, of all places, to recuperate Goldeneye, where there's no telephone or anything. And so just as I said earlier, just as the moment when Eden is collapsing, his whole reputation is sinking in a rubber dinghy, which Fleming lends him, and it does actually sink beneath him because there's a leak in it. Just as Eden is sinking, out of the same waters erupts James Bond, because suddenly the whole world's focus is on this place where the first five Bond books were written. And so after that, Fleming has to go on writing these books, and his readership grows and grows, but he still can't get them filmed. And that's what his real ambition is. He thinks he can release himself from his job if he gets the books filmed. And it's really President Kennedy who enables that. And it's rather an extraordinary story. For me, it's the most important chapter in the book. When he meets Kennedy in the year of Kennedy's presidential election in 1960, in March, in Washington, in Georgetown, the place where Fleming and Bill Donovan had, you know, done the blueprint for what is now the CIA, he meets Kennedy in the street with Jackie, and Kennedy says, not the Ian Fleming, having read all his books religiously. I mean, Kennedy was also in naval intelligence. Kennedy and Fleming, I think, shared some women. Kennedy's father was ambassador in London, just on the site, the American embassy was on the site of Fleming's grandfather's house in Grosvenor Square. They had lots of things in common. And I think Kennedy was really obsessed by Bond, and he invites him to dinner that night. And at dinner, he asks Fleming, what would Bond do about Castro, who'd been very vexatious in Havana for the last 18 months with the bearded Barbudos? And Fleming takes off. He captivates Kennedy with his answer, and all those present say it was like Kennedy was in the presence of a movie star. And many of the suggestions that Fleming makes to Kennedy about what to do with Castro seem to have been put into effect with the Bay of Pigs the following year. And it's all framed in a kind of James Bond paradigm. Bobby Kennedy, another James Bond fan, looks at the head of the task force and says, you're no James Bond. And when it all goes wrong, Bobby Kennedy says, that wouldn't have happened to 007. And this is repeated among some of those CIA people who were involved. They all saw it as a kind of James Bond story. And many of the suggestions Fleming made were put into practice in the Bay of Pigs. Now, the second thing I want to add to this is that it wasn't only Kennedy who was obsessed by Bond, it was the person who killed Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald. On the night that the From Russia with Love is showing in a private viewing, the film, in the White House projection room, Kennedy can't be there. Some of the people who were at the dinner party 2 years earlier at that showing, Kennedy's in Dallas. We all know what happens then, but when the FBI come into Lee Harvey Oswald's rooming house, they find four James Bond books there, including From Russia with Love. And they discover that that summer, Lee Harvey Oswald had been calling himself James as an alias, almost as if he wanted to be the assassin in From Russia with Love, who was named Donovan, you'll remember. So it really is an example of James Bond, really a talisman who does bad things for people who touch him, not only his author, Ian Fleming, but also people like Kennedy and the man who assassinated him. They're all touched in some way by James Bond.
Well, that's a brilliant way to capsulize just what this book is about. And I want to let our listeners know that if they're really looking for dozens and dozens of examples like the answer you just heard from Nicholas Shakespeare, you've got to read Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. Nicholas, it has been a joy reading your book. It's delightful to have the opportunity to talk with you for this last 30 minutes. Thank you so much for what you've done in helping us better understand Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. Thanks for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for inviting me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
The candidates for November are set.
Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.